shit.
Folks, welcome to episode 13 of Does It Matter?
Dun, 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 bum, bum.
We had some technical difficulties
yeah.
preceding the actual recording of this episode, so we are very pleased to actually be, you know, right. having... I should have named it Beast, because I was so, you know, very, very sure of its power. Now it's been like 7 years, and it's old and feeble.
An old limping lion.
Yeah. Seed this episode with last time that we recorded, I was like, well, you get a cover and, like, a remake, and that's kind of all you get, right? Wow, think about it for more than 10 seconds. Answers for this episode.
I know, it was hard to focus.
But here we are, and we've got all kinds of fantastic stuff. So, let's just dive right in. Do you want to go first?
I can, sure.
Let's do it.
Okay. Take a deep breath, and flip off the... What do you call it? Board. That's it. Hey, words. Words are a thing. Okay. So I sort of approach this from, I guess, a very philosophical perspective of, like, what does it mean to, like, adapt or reinterpret something? And the way I approached it, or I guess where I landed, was at three kind of, not exactly archetypes, but kinds of interpretation, I guess. It's hardly meant to be definitive or anything, but just, you know, thoughts. It's one of those, the perspective of, like, an artist or a creator, like, what kind of motivation would you have for taking on someone else's work? Mm-hmm. And, acknowledge an influence while also simultaneously making it your own. And kind of have a back and forth dialogue with it in that way. And so my first example is one. Music lends itself very well to that particular one. I think that's kind of probably what most cover songs are. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily all, but most. Pick I Am Who I Am, I tend to think of, like, the album as the level of the work, mm-hmm. rather than a song, necessarily. So I decided to go with a cover album. And most cover albums that exist are like, I'm going to cover a bunch of songs by a bunch of different people, but there is a little subset of cover albums that are, I'm going to cover an entire album by another artist. Some sort of recent famous examples of that were Ryan Adams covering Taylor Swift's 1989, but like all folksy guitar-y, like Ryan Adams style.
Sure.
And then there's also another one that I thought about was this band Japan Cakes has, like, a really cool, chill, instrumental, sometimes loveless. That's pretty neat. But the one that I decided to go with is one that, according to Nick Offerman, is perfect to build canoes to.
That is one of the most bizarre endorsements I've ever heard, but I love it.
And it's called Petra Hayden Sings the Who Sell Out.
What's the name of the artist?
Petra Hayden.
Okay.
First, The Who Sell Out. So, The Who Sell Out was the third or fourth Who album, I think. Extremely strong run that they had in the early part of their career. It came out in 1967, and it was sort of based on the concept of both parodying and paying tribute to, like, pirate radio broadcasts. So, like, tacked on to the end of songs or in between things are, like, all these weird little public service announcements and commercials and such like that. The cover art features the four of them in, like, kind of absurdly exaggerated advertisements. The front cover has, like, Pete Townsend in, like, a fisheye lens with deodorant under his arm and Roger Daltrey in a bathtub of Heinz baked beans, which is later referenced in the film version of Towie, I believe, when Anne Margaret gets beans dumped all over her. But anyway, that's a side thing.
Oh, The Who.
I know. Like, they're one of those bands that's really hard to pin down for me. Like,
it makes you ask the question, who are you?
Right? Like, you listen to a Led Zeppelin album, you pretty much know what you're gonna get. You listen to it a couple of times, but, like, they have a basic sound. Like, the Beatles don't, but they have a clear progression. But The Who, I don't know where to land with them. And, like, it was considered, like, very critically strong, but, like, a lot of people, when it came out, didn't know what to do with it. The quote that I got off of Wikipedia that I like is, its irony sat awkwardly with the serious ambitions of the underground music scene. That kind of seems like it sums up the reaction to this thing. Okay. So the adaptation was done by Petra Hayden, who was born in 1971 in New York City. I think she's primarily a violinist, and according to Wikipedia, one of a set of triplets who are daughters of the jazz bassist Charlie Hayden from the Ornette Coleman Quartet.
Oh.
Her sister Rachel is like one of the core members of the band That Dog, who I think recently reunited. And she was kind of part of that when, like, it started out. She's also been a touring member of the Decemberists. She worked with the Foo Fighters.
That's quite a resume.
Yeah. She was also apparently a longtime friend of Mike Watt from the Minutemen and Firehose, and some other cool stuff. Like, he's a friend of Sonic Youth and worked with them a lot on some weird stuff. Like, he seems like a cool guy. Apparently, he kind of suggested this project and gave her the 8-track recorder with which she made it. And the fact that it's called Petra Hayden Sings the Who Sell Out is a very, very accurate description of what it is, because the only sounds on it are her voice.
Oh.
She sings.
Oh.
So she sings the drum parts, she sings the guitar parts, she sings the weird string flourishes, she harmonizes with herself doing all the weird vocal layers and shit. It's very hard to describe, and it's an interesting choice, especially because of the, like, kind of psychedelic density of the original music. Like, it's got a lot of weird flourishes, and, you know, it's kind of one of the thicker Who albums, less in terms of weight than in terms of, like, space, if that makes sense.
Sure.
2003, released in 2005. It's a song-for-song recreation of the original track list. And I kind of pulled out two quotes about it. The first is from Tim Sendra's review on AllMusic. She pulls off the feat of being reverent to the original material while also sounding completely out on a limb artistically. That's really hard.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, this is one of those things where it's like, it's very hard to dislike. You just kind of have to hear it. So, like, I'm struggling to, like, find the right words for it. But that I have, that I sort of, like, wrote both of them down and then circled them and then pointed to all my notes about, like, this is why this is a great example of this kind of adaptation, is what Petra does with her voice, not so easy to do, is to challenge the entire rock framework, which was Pete Townsend. So, like, it got an official endorsement. Like, this is, like, there's a longer quote on Wikipedia that I didn't feel like writing down all of. But he basically, like, it's weird to, like, listen to this and then suddenly realize that, wait, I'm, like, enjoying listening to my own music and hearing something different in it that wasn't there. And, like, where she does deviate, she does it to inject a welcome bit of herself, I think was something that he said. And, like, that, I mean, that's kind of what I was trying to go for with this sort of adaptation. It's like, I am doing your thing, but I am also making it mine, and there's a push-pull between us, and it's a personal kind of one-to-one thing. And the fact that there is an audience present for it is, you know, part of the whole mix, but not really what it's about, exactly. I don't know if that makes sense.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, like I said, I would like to talk more about it, but it's a difficult one to talk about because you kind of just have to hear it. So if you haven't, I would recommend going out and doing that.
Yeah, I know, I'm going to be looking this up, like, today.
So that's my first one.
All right. Well, I also, for my first one, went with an entire album cover. Honestly, when you started cover situations, like, oh my god, is this when we finally do the same thing on the same episode? No, so I want to talk about an entire album cover of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon.
Oh.
So, a little bit about... we'll see.
Yeah,
because
there's a couple.
There's a lot. let's talk a little bit about the Pink Floyd version. Came out in 1973. It begins with some silence that builds into this sort of typewriter pulse. There's laughter, there's some screaming, there's a gentle ebb of like synthesized guitar and some jazz-style drumming. There's a bit of speech about madness. The first lines of the album are one of the members of the crew talking. They say, I've been mad for fucking years. Absolutely years. I've been over the edge for yonks. And this is very quiet. I didn't know until I researched it that's actually what speech kind of sounds like, ambient talking.
I don't think I ever knew that.
Yeah, yeah. And it's very fitting because the whole album is about the concept of madness. What drives people mad, what keeps us mad, what we define as the experience of feeling crazy. This first track is called Speak to Me and Breathe. This sort of the first real audible lyrics are breathes. It says, breathe, breathe in the air, don't be afraid to care. And it really sets up the album as like the gentle, like moving need to hold yourself back from something and the kind of trouble that can get you into. This was Pink Floyd's eighth album, and it was developed through live performances in the years before its release. It was engineered by, I'm sorry, I'm going to go back. I want to talk about the final track really quick, just sort of to bookend things. The final track is called Eclipse, and after listing everything that a person experiences in life, it says, and everything under the sun is in tune, but the sun is eclipsed by the moon. And the music really crescendos. It fades into the same pulsing heartbeat of a kick drum, and then that fades away too. So it's got that whole sense of the album beginning and ending in very similar ways. Mm-hmm. Bookend is a good way to describe it.
Returning to the original state.
Right. Like I was starting to say, it was engineered by Alan Parsons. At the time, it was technologically advanced for what was going on in the music scene. Its history is really rich, and honestly, we could do an entire episode of this podcast just about the formation of Dark Side of the Moon.
And subsequent impact.
Right. I'm not going to do that. What I do want to say about it is it's instantly recognizable, both its songs and the art and its art form. Really make up the backbone of what we call classic rock and psychedelic rock. It's one of the most respected albums in music history. It's one of the albums that has been repeatedly covered in its entirety. The tribute, I think, speaks to the legacy that it has.
Yeah.
Not many albums are covered in their entirety, but certainly even fewer this many times.
And its cohesion that, like, you can't just pull apart out of it. It is a piece.
Right. Here, I'm gonna list some of the covers of The Dark Side of the Moon in its entirety. There's the prog cover Return to the Dark Side of the Moon, which was organized by Billy Sherwood of Yes. There's the pop cover, The Not-So-Bright Side of the Moon by The Squirrels.
Mm.
The reggae cover, Dub Side of the Moon by Easy Star All Stars.
Okay.
The entirely a cappella cover, Dark Side of the Moon a cappella by Voices on the Dark Side. The bluegrass cover, Dark Side of the Moonshine by Poor Man's Whiskey. The String Quartet cover by Vitamin String Quartet.
Mm-hmm.
The industrial metal cover, Dark Side of the Spoon by Ministry. the album has also been covered in its entirety by Fish, Dream Theater. Notable samples from the album include Milli Vanilli and Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch. So clearly this has a very widespread effect on a lot of musicians.
Mm-hmm.
It also holds a very special place in my life. It's one of the first albums that I bought when I was getting into music in, like, a real earnest way. I remember listening to it over and over again with my brother while we would play Star Wars Battlefront. And that was one of the first albums that I remember getting him into. He and I don't have necessarily a lot of musical overlap. He has a sort of narrow musical taste compared to mine, which isn't to say that he has narrow musical taste, but I kind of listen to like everything.
Yeah.
And I don't say that to, yeah, I don't mean to say that to be like, oh no, I'm so cool. Like there's, I don't think that I really have anything where I'm like, nah, I'm not going to listen to that.
That's kind of the way we both seem to approach things. It's like, all right, what's this about?
I'm not a fan of screamo and that's about it.
That's a tough one.
And I will also say, I don't think I've ever listened to only one song from Dark Side of the Moon. It's kind of one of those albums you sit down, you listen to the whole thing.
Pretty much, yeah. Unless money comes on the radio.
Right. which, and that isn't that just the most ironic thing? The most commercially successful album on the song is Money, which is about how fucked up like
that is.
Industry is. So the reinterpretation I want to talk about is one of those full album covers. It is descriptively called The Flaming Lips and Star Death and White Dwarfs with Henry Rollins and Peaches doing Dark Side of the Moon.
Delivers what promises.
It really does. It was released in very late 2009. It was performed live in Oklahoma City on New Year's Eve of 2010. With Henry Rollins, who recreates all of the interview segments from the album. And immediately you start to see the way that it's going to change the album's interpretation. The opening lines, the I've been mad for fucking years thing, is a really playful sort of reflective thing on the Dark Side of the Moon. Henry Rollins, as you might expect, makes it a little bit more angry. Mm. It comes out more like, I've been mad for fucking years.
Yes, you have.
He certainly has. Meanwhile, the vocalist Peaches handles all of Claire Torrey's improvised singing throughout the album. And then you really get hit with the music. Speak to Me and Breathe becomes a more blaring song. Wayne Coyne's vocals mimic David Gilmour's delivery, including the accent on the first couple songs of the album. It becomes a lot more jammy, a lot more danceable. It kind of loses that atmospheric sense to it.
Sure.
Then you get to On the Run, which is recognizable mostly from its trademark sort of helicoptery and explosion sound effects at the beginning, but the guitar and the bass treatments are more like an electronic take on Led Zeppelin than Pink Floyd.
Hmm.
They take on the energy of the original and magnify them, even adding a blaring warning siren to the end. Then Time begins with basically an explosion of sound that could come out of like a modern Thriller or action flicks soundtrack. Those sounds very suddenly disappear and the lyrics begin, offering the first real reminder of the Flaming Lips' trademark style. Notably, the line, "Desperation is the English way," is interrupted with a sort of hiccuping sound. It just says, "Desperation," and then really heavy instrumentation comes in. Then you get The Great Gig in the Sky, which begins in the same quiet, thoughtful manner of the original, but suddenly discovers the blaring synthy guitar, which sort of matches the vocal screaming for a while, before oscillating back into sort of gentle strumming. This album, musically, is just kind of like up and down and up and down and all over the place.
Yeah, even more so than the original, it sounds like.
Oh, it's intensified in every moment, sometimes completely ignoring the momentum of the original.
Mm.
Then you get to Money, which begins not with the coins and the cash register sound effects, but with room-shaking bass and malfunctioning computer sounds. The lyrics are all processed through a talk box, which gives the entire song a distinctly inhuman feel.
Yeah, that sounds interesting.
Then Us and Them changes the synthesizer into a sort of church organ sound. It's mostly unchanged, but it has a much harsher edge and much softer synthesizers, which create a sort of sense of foreboding and contrast and conflict. Song ends a lot more softly with this immediate urgent shift into Any Color You Like, which has a really funky feel to it. It's constantly driving forward. It has these low, rumbling sounds around this sort of electric warbling from the guitars. Brain Damage is reinterpreted into this sort of swelling, gentle sound for a while until this looming, shrieking synth just threatens to overtake it completely. And again, it disappears to make way for the gentle style at the beginning, which becomes only more frenetic and intense with these unrelenting symbols towards the end. Then you get to Eclipse, the second to the, or the last album, or the last song on the album, which once again begins with this sort of intense swell, and each line of the song, and all that you make, and all, you know, etc. Every time they get to the end of one of those lines, it either ends with, or at least includes, all of the instruments dropping out in this sort of chaotic, like, half-stuttered fashion. That's for the first half of the song, which only makes the music continuing in the second half of the album feel more pressing and kind of unexpected. And then that same heartbeat leads out at the end of the album as the original, with Rollins coming back in, and you can hear him a lot more clearly than in the original. He says, "There is no dark side of the moon, it's all dark." So ultimately, this cover version of the album represents the feeling of going mad. It's got this sort of all over the place, you can't predict what's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's almost uncomfortable sometimes, because pressure builds and then all of a sudden it disappears, and it's not a relief. It's like, where did all of it go? I thought I understood what was happening, and now I feel that I don't.
Waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Right. As far as I'm concerned, it's an incredible reinterpretation in that it unveils part of the original's meaning. It sacrifices all of the subtlety of the original to mimic madness, and it highlights what was sort of just referred to in the original, and makes it something in the original, and makes it its own. It feels like if the Flaming Lips were going to make the album, certainly, but it also makes the original and substitutes something a lot bigger and bolder.
Yeah, and edits it differently.
And I think a lot of times when something gets reinterpreted, there's a tendency to want to say, like, oh, it's better than the original, it's not as good as the original, to compare them. You can't really compare the Flaming Lips and, I want to get the title correct again, the Flaming Lips and Star Death and White Dwarfs with Henry Rollins and Peaches doing Dark Side of the Moon. It's not the same, but it is the same. You can't really compare them because they're attempting to do two completely different things. And I think that's the mark of a good reinterpretation.
Yeah.
Especially when you're going for an entire album cover.
This is true, because that's a lot.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like a bigger responsibility, just this is a record about something.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, you look at, you can do a cover song and do it as close to the original or as distant from the original as you want. It's much more ambitious and,
it's
in
much
a way,
more of a commitment.
Yeah, it carries more responsibility artistically.
Yeah.
So those are apparently our music entries.
So moving on, this one's kind of a twofer.
Ooh.
In that, like, usually we seem to do like music, book, movie. This one is both book and movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is a second kind of adaptation, which is like adapting to a different medium and taking into account the concerns, conventions, capabilities of that medium. And especially when you're adapting this kind of reflexive desire to be like, oh, the book was better, because literature does different things, like it can cover more and it can penetrate very deep in a very different way.
Mm-hmm.
So like a lot of times, I don't want to say that that's true because I don't believe it, but I understand that reflexive impulse that, like, okay, yeah, there's a richness in the book that the movie doesn't have because it can't, because it exists on an equivalent level to a short story, you know. But there are also, like, kind of notable exceptions to that reflexive reaction to, like, places where people are like, no, actually, the movie's better than the book. And I'm going to talk about one of those where even the author of the book, who has a bit part in the movie, is like, no, he did something great with it that I didn't think of.
Oh.
And it's also a movie that I really like. I have this weird moment of, I took a class in college that was, like, one of my favorite classes that I've ever taken that was, like, very much about this subject, where, like, we read a bunch of books and then watched the movies based on those books, and we're like, all right, what did they do differently? Why might they have made those choices? Like, that kind of shit. And this was one of them, and, like, this was one of a couple times in college, where it's like, who's seen this movie? And, like, it's like, oh, just me. Okay. That's fine. That's cool. Because it's very sad. And it's called The Sweet Hereafter.
Oh.
So, the story is based loosely on a true incident that actually happened in Texas. In the book, it's set in a small town in upstate New York. In the movie, it's set in Canada because the director is Canadian and had to, like, that was, like, one of the things he did to, like, secure better financing. It's like, nope, Canada. But it is the story of a school bus crash that kills or severely injures most of the children in this small town.
Yeah, I see where the sadness comes in.
Yeah. The novel was written in 1991 by Russell Banks, who was born in 1940 in Newton, Massachusetts. He won an O. Henry Award for a short story collection called Searching for Survivors in 1975. Other famous books of his are like Continental Drift, Cloud Splitter, and Affliction, which was also made into a pretty good movie. He's kind of compared a lot to, like, sort of a Raymond Carver-ish thing, where it's, like, realism kind of focusing on, like, the emotional lives of marginalized characters and, like, things like that. That kind of earthy approach, I guess. The novel is constructed as it's divided into five sections that are first-person narratives from four of the participants. You get one person twice. She goes first and last. That's Dolores Driscoll. She is the driver of the school bus.
Oh.
You also get this dude named Billy Ainsel, who is a single father of two children who are killed in the crash, who is also, like, having an affair with this other lady in town, and how, like, his whole emotional life gets fucked up by this shit. You get Mitchell Stevens Esquire, who is, like, a fancy big city lawyer, who comes up to the town basically ambulance chasing to, like, try and find a way to assign blame for this thing, and to profit from that assignment.
Certainly.
But also, like, carrying all this baggage about, like, his own relationship with his daughter, who's, like, addicted to drugs and in and out of rehab and going through all this other crazy shit, and, like, how he brings that into this situation. You get Nicole Burnell, who is a teenager who was on the bus when it crashed and is now paralyzed and is also being abused by her father, who is one of, like, Mitchell's most enthusiastic clients. And so, like, that creates this weird dynamic that, like, pushes on the situation, whereas, like, on the other side, you have, like, Billy Ainsel kind of being the force pushing against that. Like, you can't assign blame to this. This is meaningless. And, like, Nicole and Dolores are kind of caught in the middle. It's a very heady mixture, and it's really interesting. Each character is, like, very much grappling with the situation from their point of view, and it's about how, like, all these outside influences and competing truths are kind of pushing against the situation and shaping it to play out the way that it does. It's a really good book. It's really fascinating. I liked it a lot. But the film is something really goddamn special. The film was made in 1999 by Canadian director Adam O'Goyan, who was born in 1960 in Cairo. He's now based in Toronto. He He has a number of other movies. Kind of some of the most famous ones are Exotica from 1994 and Ararat, which came out in 2002 and was the Genie Best Picture that year, which is like the Canadian Oscars, basically. He's like kind of one of the like big names in new Canadian cinema. And this film in particular is like a really enduring one of his. The Toronto International Film Festival occasionally releases a list of like, these are the best Canadian movies ever, voted on by like critics and filmmakers and shit. And The Sweet Hereafter has been number 3 on that list both times it's come out since the film's release.
Wow.
It stars Ian Holm as Mitchell Stevens, Sarah Polley as Nicole Burnell, Bruce Greenwood as Billy Ansel, Gabrielle Rose as Dolores Driscoll. Ian Holm's the biggest name there. Sarah Polley shows up in some pretty interesting stuff too, though. Bruce Greenwood, his face is so familiar, but I can't actually place him from anything but this. It also has a 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
There you go.
Even now, almost 20 years after its release. But it's not considered a huge box office success, but it did win Grand Jury at Cannes, and it was nominated for 2 Oscars. Best Director, which lost to Titanic. And
I want to point out to people who can't see it, that was like a body-straining eye roll.
Yeah, a little bit. And then Best Adapted Screenplay, which it lost to L.A. Confidential, and that one I'm a little more okay with.
Okay.
Because L.A. Confidential is such a damn good movie. Fuck. But the film does a number of things differently than the book. Primarily because the way the book is structured, like, it has that very first person kind of, you're reading this person's stream of thoughts, and that's very difficult to do in a movie. So instead, what it does is something Egoyan does in a number of his films, where he just, like, fucks up the timeline. And so the narrative flashes back and forth from before the accident, after the accident, different periods in the past. There's, like, a moment where, like, Ian Holm, sometime after the accident, is talking to someone on a plane and flashes back to, like, when his daughter was a kid, like, timelines within timelines kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, it keeps you oriented pretty well with things like, you know, locational differences. Like, okay, he's on the plane at this point in the story. Like, he shows up at this point, and you know that because there's a calendar in this scene. Like, it kind of keeps you grounded that way. Other kind of notable aspects of it are it includes multiple both overt and subtextual references to the story of the Pied Piper of Hamelin.
Okay.
Which has Nicole reading that to like Billy Ansel's kids when she's babysitting them. There's like narration over other parts of the film. It's also very notably referenced in the soundtrack, which is really interesting. It's this like combination of like medieval music and very like atmospheric tones. It's really cool. Part of what's so interesting and enduring about it is, like, that reference to the Pied Piper that it makes kind of casts the whole narrative in this different light. It becomes more broad, I guess. Like, the book is very much about these specific people in this specific situation, and, like, their kind of, their grief is universal, but by, like, turning the story into almost this kind of weird fable, it opens it up a little bit. The timeline structure also allows for, like, reveals to happen at different places. Like, the reveal about Nicole and her father comes later in the movie than it does in the book, that kind of thing. It paces it differently, which makes it flow better as a narrative, I think. Like, the book is interesting and kind of, like, piecemeal, but it doesn't have quite the same, like, climactic rise that the film has. It doesn't hurt that the film is also really beautiful. Like, it captures kind of this like wintry, chilly feel that is in the text, but like seeing it landscaped out in front of you is something else. And I think, like, it's a really good example of seeing something in a novel that is like, okay, this is a very different structure that lends itself very well to this, but, like, what can I do to make that something more appropriate for a different medium? And it strengthens it in the process. So.
Well, that's another one we'll be checking out soon.
It's, maybe don't end on it.
Yeah. man, I do love the really sad shit, though.
I know, and it's so good at that. It's just like this... I watched it with Kat not too long ago, and she was like, what is it that you like about this? And it's like, it's just an emotional experience. Like, it's not... There is an intellectual underpinning to it in, like I said, like, the way that it's restructured and the way that it deploys, but the performances are all fantastic, and there's just this brutally aching quality to it that is overwhelming. Well, it would have been a good one for Pit of Despair, too.
Yeah, I was just about to say. It's those good double picks. Well, we've got some good parallel structure going this episode, because I also, for my second example, went for a book-to-film adaptation.
Okay.
And part of what I really, the heart of what I wanted to focus on are the choices that you have to make when you move from the written word to the visual medium. And I think I'm going to be coming at it from a little bit of a different angle, partially because... You come from the world of film, I come from the world of literature.
Mm-hmm.
So, what I want to talk about is Misery.
Ah.
The 1987 novel by Stephen King and the 1990 film by Rob Reiner.
Which is... That one always throws me off. It's like, wait, Meathead directed that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, I had seen Misery before I read the book. Then I read the book, and then I rewatched the movie just to get some notes on it for the podcast, and Rob Reiner's name came up, and I was like, wait, really? I must have missed that the first time. So yeah, it's an interesting one. So both versions deal with author Paul Sheldon and crazed fan Annie Wilkes. Both of them, the basic plot is, Paul crashes his car in the Colorado mountains and is rescued by Annie, who claims to be his number one fan. She's dissatisfied with his decision to kill off Misery, his most popular character, and...
Misery Crapton cannot be dead!
She forces him to write a new novel, which brings Misery back to life. The film Misery is perhaps the best Stephen King adaptation to film.
Definitely in the top three.
Right. Of the at least 73 film versions of his books, it's the only one to have ever won an Academy Award.
For Kathy Bates.
Kathy Bates won the Oscar for Best Actress. It stars Bates and James Caan, and is, by my estimate, about 65% faithful to the book.
Which, for a King adaptation, is pretty good.
Yeah. So I take it you've seen the movie?
Not in some time, but yes.
Okay. Have you read the book?
I have not.
Okay. So that's kind of how I feel like most people are. Mm. It's one of those movies where, like, it's the most likely... It's the most, oh my gosh, let me try to say this one more time. It's the film that of Stephen King's work that I think people are most likely to have seen, and for some reason, one of the books of his that people are least likely to have read.
Okay.
It's odd that way.
I can see that.
Which I think it's such a strange phenomenon, because I think Misery is absolutely one of his best books at all.
Hmm.
And it's the classic book-to-film adaptation problem. They're different media, and they require different approaches. The film Misery contains a lot of the classic book-to-film issues. You have to condense and omit plot points for time and space constraints. You have to change details, which the condensing and omitting make awkward.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to change plot elements, which work in print but not on screen.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny that you had said, like, there's that impulse to say, like, the book is better than the movie in so many cases. After reading and watching another Stephen King work,
mm-hmm.
I was like, you know what? I'm going to have either a podcast or a YouTube show called Yeah, But the Book Was Better. book and movie, Firestarter. Firestarter movie is pretty trash, but the book is really compelling. And there's a lot of bizarre changes made. One which I will mention now, it's like so minor. Opening scene in the book, the main character and his daughter, who are on the run from like a government agency who's trying to track them down because they have special powers.
It's one of those like flashback kind of things.
It actually starts there.
Yeah.
So they get into a cab, and the cab driver, Stephen King notes, is black.
Mm.
It's completely irrelevant, but like, that's how it is. In the movie version, they get into a cab, the cab driver is white, and the white cab driver spends all of his dialogue complaining about black people. That's the kind of change that made me go, I need to write about this, I need to address this kind of thing, because why would you make that kind of change? It doesn't add anything, it's not a meaningful alteration in any way.
That seems like a strange choice.
So why do that? I am inclined, in the case of Misery, to say the book is better, but that's not the point here. The point is to address the changes and why they were probably made. So the most obvious point of divergence with Misery is that in the book, you actually get to read portions of the book that Paul writes for Annie, called Misery's Return. Not only do these sections give the reader a sense of how Paul writes to Annie's taste in particular, a couple examples. She has some neighbors who she hates called the Roydmans.
Mm-hmm.
She's constantly complaining about them. Mm-hmm. He adds this little like one throwaway sentence in Misery's Return that one of the characters recently had to tend to the fact that the Roydman child, a baby that was recently born to the Roydman family, died. Just for her benefit. He also names a nurse character Annie Wilkes, just for her.
Mm-hmm.
But they also reflect how King feels about the writing process. And this is really sort of at the core of the huge difference between the book Misery and the film Misery.
Yeah.
The book Misery is about the writing process.
It's a metaphor.
It is. It's a big metaphor, which is at times very overt and at times very subtle. One of the subtle ways, a couple of the subtle ways, the very opening lines of Misery, the book, he's talking about this, like, fading into and out of consciousness after his accident. And the memory that keeps coming to him is, as a child, he went to the beach with his family, and he saw these pilings out on the beach. And when tide was low, you could see them in their entirety, but when the tide was high, they were completely covered.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would sit on the beach and he would just watch them slowly emerge and then disappear. He describes his pain when he's in this semi-conscious state as feeling the pilings coming in and out and seeing them over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when he's writing Misery's Return, those pilings show up again. There's a character who's in emotional pain, and he describes his emotional pain receding and reemerging as pilings.
Hmm.
So you get to see how in Misery's Return.
Sure.
But you get to see that connection. He also talks...
little, like, distillations.
Yeah. He also talks about how being kept in a situation that makes you feel like you are being held back makes you feel like an African bird in a zoo, which is exactly how he describes... how Paul describes himself... as being kept by Annie.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to see stuff like that. These passages get included and they build towards this this role that the writing process plays in the book. The whole story is a metaphor for how King feels about writing. The 1984 novel that he wrote, The Eyes of the Dragon, was rejected by most fans because it wasn't a horror story. The book that he writes, the book that Paul writes in Misery, Fast Cars, gets rejected by Annie because it's not a Misery book.
Mm-hmm.
Now the film has to lose these sort of writing process things because the film is not interested in the process of writing a book and your relationship with your fans.
The film films about writing books are tough.
Right.
Films about creating any kind of art are tough, except for films.
Not only is writing not the point, but to add in these sort of narrative elements that Paul has, even just to include any excerpt from Misery's Return in the film would add like 20 minutes to it. Mm. And it would just be for the sake of the writing process metaphor. So again, it doesn't get included. There's also a major perspective shift. In the book, you never see anything that Paul doesn't experience.
Mm.
Pretty much the entire book, with the exception of the epilogue, takes place in Annie's house. 90% of it takes place in one room. The film, however, follows Paul. It follows Annie when she's out of the house. It also follows the town sheriff, who's named Buster.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the book feels claustrophobic because it's so focused in Paul and his tiny guest room. The film is going less for claustrophobia and more for suspense.
Yeah.
Because it shows how all of these plot lines are building towards a point of convergence. It's worth noting, at this point, Buster doesn't even exist in the book. Like, he's a complete fabrication for the film. He's sort of, in a way, a rolling up of, like, three characters who you kind of see in the last third of the book, who are all law enforcement characters.
Okay.
But law enforcement characters never do the thing that Buster does, which is actually try to track Paul Sheldon down. He's you know, no one's trying to find Paul the way that Buster has this gut feeling that something bad has happened, that he's constantly tracking him down.
Okay.
I think the film invents him to create suspense through his investigation, because you constantly see him getting closer and closer to discovering Paul. I'm going to note here, I'm going to talk about some spoilers.
Mm. I mean, both of these things are 30-some years old.
Right. This is very fair. There's a scene in sort of the Act 2 to Act 3 sequence in the film where Buster discovers Paul in Annie's house and is immediately blown away by Annie with a shotgun.
Oh, yeah. I vaguely remember that.
Now, Buster's death there shows Annie's brutality, and it provides an emotional climax. But the book doesn't need to do that, because Annie's brutality is everything in the book.
Yeah, soaked into it.
Annie's character in the film is, like, so soft compared to the Annie in the book. Right. Annie in the film is terrifying, but
yeah,
she has nothing on book Annie.
Like, there's a reason Kathy Bates won that Oscar.
Paul is actually proportionally softened in... is proportionally softer in the book.
Mm.
He's the kind of person who would, like, barely lift a finger to upset Annie unless he's doing it to try to get something. There's a scene in the film where...
Just as a quick aside, I've noticed that, like, King's writer stand-in characters are often a lot more wishy-washy in the books than in the adaptations thereof.
They are. I mean, like, Paul in the book is resourceful. He's crafty. He's clever. But he understands, looking at Annie, that he holds no cards.
Yeah.
Almost no cards. And he's afraid of her, as anybody would be, based on the way she is in the book.
Yeah.
Like, there's a scene in the book, or in the movie, where Annie's outside his window, and she's like, "Hey, Paul, just got back, good to see ya," and he just flips her off through the window. I will tell you right now, if he flipped her off in the book, he probably would have died for it.
Fuck.
Like, it's... And here's some examples of how fucked up Annie actually is in the book. Within Act 1, she withholds pain meds to make a point to him. Like, he's literally crying from pain and begging.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where he actually, like... There's a scene in both the book and the film where he is sort of forced to burn the manuscript for his old book.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In the movie, it happens, and it's almost, like, inexplicable. Like, he does it because he feels like he's, like, in a situation where he kind of has to. He's literally doing it because he's crying from pain and he wants the pain to end in the book. He's forced to do it because he's being essentially tortured. There's also the rat scene, which doesn't exist in the movie. Annie finds a rat in a rat trap in the basement, brings it up to Paul's room. It's not dead yet.
Mm.
She proceeds to squeeze it to death.
Oh.
And then lick its blood off of her hands in front of him without even noticing that she's doing it. It's one of the most disturbing things. And that I think that happens in, like, Act 1.
Right.
So... So then, of course, like, if I were to ask you to name, like, one fucked up scene from the movie, what would you go with?
Like I said, it's been quite some time since I've seen it. What stands out in my mind are three scenes. There's the sledgehammer in the legs.
Yep, the sledgehammer in the legs. That's what I'm looking for.
Okay.
Sledgehammer in the legs does not exist in the book.
Okay.
She instead uses an axe.
Oh, fuck.
Completely takes his foot off.
Shit.
Yeah, she also, at one point, cuts off his thumb, takes it out of the room, brings back a birthday cake. The thumb is a candle.
What?
And some of these, I think, could not happen in the movie, as a matter of special effects. Taking a thumb and a foot off of a person... really hamper your ability to just, like, focus on the actual progress of the plot.
Returning that thumb as a candle might be a little visually absurd.
Right. But on the whole, it seems as though the film wanted Annie to be believably tender and violent at the same time, give her a little bit of a mood swing so that you're afraid of the way that you might affect her mood.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the book, the point is that you can't do anything to affect her mood. She swings from one extreme to the other, seemingly with no rhyme or reason to it.
I see.
Which makes the chaos that much more terrifying.
Okay.
Another difference would be that in the movie, she sort of falls in love with Paul. She's constantly saying, I love you. They have a romantic dinner together.
Yeah.
Like, she has no emotional feelings for him in the book. It is simply her drive to get a book out of him.
Yeah, he's a means to an end.
Right. Now, I suppose that the film version of Annie is a lot more believable as a human being, like, as a character. She's someone who you could actually believe exists out there.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, making her as severe as she is important because Annie is a metaphor. She's the unforgiving audience. And King has also said in interviews, she's also a representation of his own drug addiction.
Mm.
She's someone who makes things that difficult. She's someone who presses him to his worst. She punishes him. She puts him through pain. The last difference that I want to note is the ending of the book and the film. So the book ends with Paul totally hysterical, having just murdered Annie out of some form of self-defense.
Does he do it with a pig in the book?
He does not. Mm-hmm. He stuffs her mouth full of the flaming manuscript, as he does in the film.
Just for someone, like, who is not at all familiar with the story, this must sound so fucking bizarre.
Yeah, there's like, he kills her with a pig? No, she smashes her head into a mantelpiece, and I will say the film did a better version, because she smashes her head instead on the typewriter, which is a better metaphor. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
The pig statue, I was not as much a fan of. But the thing is, Paul
it made
is...
an impression.
Paul hallucinates Annie coming back to life like 5 different times.
Mm.
So when the state troopers show up to the house, and you actually see them show up to the house, he's freaking out. Like, no, she's still alive. You have to kill her. They don't even find her in the house. Like,
no.
She apparently gets up and leaves.
Fuck.
Which is that much more terrifying. So he gets rescued by these state troopers who had been sort of sniffing around lately. And then... he goes back to New York after, like, a year. He has released the book that he wrote for her, and it is, like, the most phenomenal bestseller. He, like in the film, has said, I'm not going to write a nonfiction account of it because I just can't do it. And then he returns to his apartment. He hallucinates that she's in the apartment. And finally, for the first time in a year, he's able to sit down and return to writing a book. And so there's that writing metaphor brought all the way back around. Even after all of the ridiculous shit, he's able to get back to writing. And writing is something that redeems him and makes him feel like he's able to create again. The film ends instead with a sort of similar hallucination where he's in a restaurant and the waitress is Annie. And when he finally snaps out of it and realizes it's just a waitress, she comes up and she says, "Hi, I'm your number one fan." Which echoes exactly what it had at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
And the book as well. And it's a nice effect, but it doesn't redeem him in the way that the book does.
Yeah.
It just kind of reminds you this was a chilling sort of suspense film.
Which it is.
It is. It's a fantastic film, and it's a great example of how the novel-to-film process has to change things. And what I want to say to people, if you haven't experienced either, watch the movie, because it's a fantastic film, and then go back and read the book. The book is going to fill in a lot of stuff, and God, I tell you, we're going to be so impressed by how much more terrifying Annie actually is.
Which sometimes doesn't seem possible.
I didn't think that it was, and then I started reading the book, and I was just so floored. Yeah. I mean, the King has a gift for describing people who are deranged, and I think Annie Wilkes may hold the prize for the most deranged Stephen King character that I've ever read.
Yeah, I could see that. Cool. I'm kind of low energy today, so I'm not like talking a whole lot.
Oh, I slammed one of those half coffee, half energy drinks before we started, which is why I'm talking at this particular pace.
Making up the balance.
Our average energy is about where it normally is.
All right. So for my third thing, I'm going to kind of break format a little bit. In that I'm going to talk reference something that I have talked about before, and I'm also going to talk about something that is not out yet.
Oh. Something that is not out yet is a first for us.
Uh-huh. And I'm talking about it because its mere existence is this kind of third kind of adaptation that I was thinking about, which is something that we're seeing a lot more of now than I think we have historically, just kind of like in terms of like this remake nostalgia culture in which we exist. And it's adaptation less as, how did I phrase it, as recontextualization. It's not across mediums necessarily, and it's not about like a direct artistic communication. It's more about a perpetuation. Like, I experienced this thing, and I want to not only re-experience it as I am now, but also introduce it to other people who have not experienced it. Like, it's kind of epitomized by the phrase, "for a new generation." And the thing that I chose is something that is sort of near and dear to me, which I think I kind of talked about. And then that is the upcoming remake of Final Fantasy VII. So, I talked about Final Fantasy VII, I think, in a previous episode. So I'm not going to go, like, super into it, but in case we missed that, it was a game released for the PlayStation in 1997. It was, like, one of the first big video games that I bought. Follows the story of, like, this guy who starts out as, like, a mercenary joining a group of environmental terrorists, basically, and then evolves into this crazy-ass plot involving, like, aliens and clones and the destruction of the world by a giant meteor. It's pretty weird, but, like, in a fun way, in an exciting way.
It's the Final Fantasy way.
Yeah, exactly. Like, just a little bit over the top. Just enough over the top. It was a big deal. Like, it sold a bajillion copies and games ever lists. I think it was, like, in the 30s on Game Informer's recent 300 best games of all time list that they put out. That was, like, in my bathroom for a while. So, everybody kind of collectively shit themselves at E3 when, in 2015, when they were like, we're gonna redo it! And that started that whole, like, thing that always happens whenever they announce a remake, that it's like, oh, should they even be doing this? Preserve the legacy of the original. Versus, like, oh, I wonder what kind of cool shit they're gonna do to, like, spice it up and make it different. Or, like, how are they gonna do this part? The one that sort of generated a lot of that is the scene where, like, oh god, I don't even remember exactly why it's happening. You're, like, trying to sneak in somewhere, but you have to disguise yourself as, in drag as a prostitute in order to do that.
Okay.
So, like, you go to this, like, weird bathhouse in the slums where some shit is clearly happening, but, like, it's that weird 3D model, like, between pixels and realistic graphics, where, like, everything just looks weird and awkward and oddly shaped and strangely cartoonish. And, like, the degree to which you decide to dress up involves on, like, how many little rooms in this bathhouse you want to go into. Like,
all
you really need is, like, a wig and a dress, but you can also get, like, makeup and perfume and other shit as well. And, like, seeing that in modern terms, like, a modern style of game is gonna be weird.
Yeah.
But it seems like they kind of can't not do it, also. Because we don't know a whole lot about this game yet. Like, mostly what we know is based on two trailers that have come out in the past 3 years. But there's a really neat video that I think it's GameSpot has that shows, like, this is a scene from the trailer. This is the scene in the original game. Side by side, it's the same thing that's happening, but the modern game is more detailed. It has, like, more dialogue. There's more interaction between the characters. The cinematic effects are look more like a movie, and, like, the characters in it behave more, as opposed to, like, video games characters from, like, olden times who would, like, make weird expressions because they only had, like, 5 different sprites. And, like, it's coming from that and moving toward something that is more like a film. It also is going to have a totally different combat style, that's more like, the original was like very active time battle perfected kind of thing, and this is like more real time, single character control kind of shit, it looks like, based on the like 15 seconds of gameplay footage that exists. It's also apparently, according to one of the directors, whose name I didn't write down because by this point I was tired of writing things, it's going to be a multi-game release. Because they are increasing the scale but maintaining the scope in such a way that they can't fit it into one game, apparently.
Hot damn.
So, I don't know how to feel about it. Like, it sits in this, and like, my approach to this one is kind of less like intellectual and structural than the other two, than just like a kind of a personal reaction sort of thing. But, like, it sits in this weird, uncomfortable place, whereas it's, like, part of me is, like, why are we spending this kind of time and this kind of energy, especially since, like, I'm in my 30s now and I don't have the time for video games that I was having the other day, where it's, like, do I really want to finish this game that I only kind of care about, or do I want to, like, go back and replay a game that I really like,
yeah.
Or do I want to read a book, you know?
So many options.
Yeah. And it's like, do I really want to invest God fucking knows how many hours into this thing? Because, like, the original was a good 40-hour run. And if they are scaling it up in such a way,
who knows?
Yeah. It could, like, I don't know. A single chapter of it could be, like, a 10 or 15-hour experience, and who knows how many of those there'll be. Another scene, just going off on tangents because that's what I'm doing right now. Another scene that I really sort of look forward to seeing how they do is a weird slap fight on a giant cannon.
Right.
I
see that being like a fun quick time event scenario.
Yeah, exactly. yeah, there's like some of the more absurd elements of the plot I'm really curious about. Like, all the weird clone shit and, like, altered memory stuff. I'm very curious how they're gonna do that, because without going into too much detail, like, the main character's memories are not all entirely his.
Oh.
I don't know. But, like, I'm so curious, and, like, I'm almost kind of resentful of the fact that I'm curious, because it's like, I've already experienced this. Why can't I leave it alone? Why do I feel the need to re-experience it, and to re-inhabit it, and to make it something different? What is that urge? Because that's the kind of urge that this kind of adaptation seems to scratch, and it feels like very prescient. Cogent, I guess, like, on point.
I mean, there's a similar, I mean, certainly distinctly different, but a similar way to the fact shooters get released, like, every year,
mm-hmm.
that are the same game, essentially, but with minor tweaks,
yeah.
and there's still that urge. I mean, part of it is, like, I need to be plugged into the new multiplayer community, but, I mean, like, oh man, they put out a new Halo. Like, I've been playing Halo for 15 years.
Which they are, aren't they?
I'm sure they are. I was one of those people who played Halo, like, 14 hours a day. And when they put out the next Halo, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna get it, even though it's gonna be the same game. Maybe they're all the same weapons still. Like, they're not changing anything but the maps and, like, the graphics.
Yeah.
And it's still, like, oh, I have to go get it.
And I think, like, where I was kind of going with that is it's a way of, like, reaffirming identity, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, I had this experience with this thing, and, like, that experience can still exist in a different context.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sort of troubling in a way. Whereas it's like, I don't want to speak for other people, I'm going to speak for myself. Am I grasping at straws that much in terms of, like, how I'm orienting myself in the world? But also, like, I totally understand it. Like, it's a way of creating touchstones when touchstones are being eradicated or moved or things like that. So I feel like that's a pretty powerful motivation for adaptation and deserves a kind of recognition.
Certainly.
And that's my third one.
Oof. Yeah, I'm intrigued to see. I mean, like, having not played the original Final Fantasy VII, maybe this would be a good entry point. I've never played a Final Fantasy game. Which I know a lot of people would say makes me a bad gamer, and that's it's fine. Maybe this will be the fun entry point.
Maybe, I don't know.
Game remakes are such an interesting thing, because I feel like the majority of the time it's just graphical updates. If people are to change too much when they remake a game, it always arises all...
pisses people
me,
off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, people are going to decry the fact it's, like, not the same game anymore.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, do you really want to spend $60 on a game that
you
played
that
looks slightly better?
Yeah. And, like, I haven't played the Tomb Raider reboot yet. I got a copy of it during a sale. I'm sort of curious about that from a similar perspective. Like, I have less of a relationship with Tomb Raider, but it's like, this seems like a redesign in the spirit of what the original, like, thought it was.
I have not played the original Tomb Raider games. I played the reboot, the first one. I haven't played the second one that they did. It's an interesting game. I will say this, the company that makes it is the same company that makes, like, Assassin's Creed and Hitman Absolution.
Sure.
And they are all essentially the same game. You find a variety of weapons, you move in the same exact way, the mechanics are all the same,
mm-hmm.
you kill enemies in the same way. The stories are all vaguely similar. The graphics all look exactly the same. So if you want to play a game that's like 60% Tomb Raider and 40% Assassin's Creed, the new ones are pretty cool. But they have, as far as I'm concerned, like, next to no replayability.
Mm.
The combat is not interesting enough to replay. The story is not good enough to re-experience. And the, like, finding things, like the platforming element of it, is...
Fetch quests and collects and shit.
Yeah, there's just a lot of, like, okay, now you're climbing this thing. And now you're jumping across this thing. And you can't solve this puzzle right now because you don't have the upgraded tool yet, so you're going to have to come back. If you're into stuff like that, which I personally am not, then it's exactly that experience, but...
Sometimes it can be fun. Like, Zelda games do that a lot, but in that case, it's a, like, here's the thing. Figure out how to deal with it. Oh, you can't right now because you don't have a thing, but you don't know that. You don't realize it until you get the thing. And then it's like, aha! Like, which is way more fun than, oh, I don't have, like, pickaxe plus four yet.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'll come back later.
One thing that I will give the new Tomb Raiders a lot of credit for is Lara Croft is not sexualized.
That's
points there.
Kind of the thing that I remember reading about it was, like, in the context of, like, a lot of female gamers being like, hey, this is cool. Let me check this out.
Well, I was genuinely surprised because the point of Tomb Raider, the original, as far as I've read, is check it out. Lara Croft is, like, a sexual object.
Super pointy boobs.
Yeah. And then so I got the new one, and if you get, like, the special edition, you unlock, like, 10 outfits from the get-go. And I was like, okay, let's see which one is the most revealing, just to laugh at how ridiculous they are.
Yeah.
And, like, most of them are, like, normal size shorts, and, like, the most revealing would be, like, a tank top. It's like, they really went out of their way, almost, to make sure that she isn't sexualized.
Yeah.
Which I had a lot of respect for. It was like, oh yeah, good for you. You didn't go the easy fan service route there.
Yeah, which you very well could have.
Right. That part of the reboot, I like, yes, you reinterpreted.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just reminded of the fact that Dead or Alive Beach Volleyball exists.
Oh yeah.
Anyway.
I had successfully forgotten about that.
Yep. Sorry.
Dead or Alive. Let's cleanse our palates with the final entry to reinterpretations. I am also talking about something that's already been talked about on this show.
Mm-hmm.
Hooray for a complete episode of Parallels.
Woo, synchronicity.
This is a piece of media that we talked about on our Hot Streak episode.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about Fargo.
Okay.
That is
an apt one.
So... Fargo was a, what was it, 1994, 1996? 96 movie, which inspired the 2014 to present TV series, which was created by Noah Hawley. I believe that's how it's pronounced.
I think so.
That's
how I'd say it. I don't know. It's weird, like, how many words you've only ever seen written, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
We've already talked about it. I don't want to talk too much about just, like, basically what it is, but it is an anthology series which is united by common characters. There are, each season has at least one character in common with another season. The first season and the second season are united by Lou Salverson.
Yeah, the dad.
He's like a 60 or 70 year old ex-cop. In the first season, we see him when he's in his, like, 30s or 40s. In the second season. In the first season, there is a hitman who we only know as Mr. Wrench. He is a deaf hitman. And he shows up in the third season, a couple of years later, on a prison bus. He helps another main character, or he helps a main character break out of that bus, and he's in the season for, like, another 3 episodes or something.
Yeah, becomes a part of it.
Yeah. But, those links aren't really the point. It's just these fun little, like, almost Easter eggs. Like, oh, look, so that's what, you know, makes this all one cohesive unit.
Mm-hmm.
They largely, though, tell their own stories in very distinct ways. Other common factors include connections to the film Fargo via plot elements and cinematic styles. The creator, Noah Hawley, at one point has said that all of the entries in the Fargo TV series belong in one big book, which they literally make in the second season. It's like a true crime anthology book, which narrates sort of the end of the second season.
I kind
of
remember that.
Right. He has said something like, the second season is like chapter two in that book, and the first season is something like chapter nine, where Fargo, the movie, is chapter seven. So, I mean, he's going for, like, something that is sort of an all-inclusive true crime, but not actually true crime.
Crime in Minnesota.
Yeah. And the cinematic styles include a lot of small details. The one that is sort of the most apparent, because it begins every episode, is at the beginning of the movie Fargo, it says, "This is a true story, the events depicted, etc., etc." The names have been changed otherwise. And yeah, none of them, the movie, all of the seasons are not true. But they do an interesting thing in the first two seasons. When it says this is a true story, all of the words fade away except true. In the third season, they change that, and it's all of the only word that's left is story.
Story. Yeah, I remember
and I still don't quite know why they decided to make that change between the seasons, but that's not the point here.
I don't know yet. Like, I feel like that's part of something that they're doing with the series as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious to see how they push that forward, but we're not getting a new one until next year.
Right.
Anyway.
So, aside from being, as far as I know, this is, I think, like, if not the first time, one of the very first times that a movie has been turned into a TV series.
One of relatively few, yeah.
Right.
Westworld's up there. Which was also a novel,
right.
So, like, that was even... Who knows?
So, aside from being a fairly unique way to assemble a TV series, each season is incredibly well-written, well-acted, and well-shot. We've sort of talked... I mean, you really covered that well, I think, in our Hot Streak episode. What I want to talk about here is the nature of how it is adapted, and a personal theory that I have about Coen Brothers' films' influence on each season.
Okay.
I'm
very curious.
So first off, there's season one, which is the most direct descendant of the movie Fargo.
Very much so, yeah.
There is at least one article out there listing many similarities between season one and Fargo. This is, however, where I want to talk about my personal theory about each season as a distinct adaptation of Coen Brothers' work.
Okay.
My theory is... each season combines Fargo with another Coen Brothers film to get the general plot and stylistic elements down.
Okay.
In the case of season one, just briefly, a hitman shows up in town to...
or something. It's kind of unclear
It's unclear what Lorne Malvo is.
Yeah, he might be the actual devil.
Very literally, he might be the actual devil. He says at one point, after eating some apple pie, that's the tastiest apple I've had since the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
Which is pretty direct.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of about him and this job that he's doing on a Greek guy who owns a supermarket chain, but it's also... and he's played by Billy Bob Thornton.
The hitman, not the Greek guy.
Right.
That's Oliver Platt.
Then there's Martin Freeman, who's in a bad marriage, who kind of accidentally kills his wife. And requires the help of Billy Bob Thornton to cover it up.
Yeah, kind of accidentally. That's a good way of putting it.
And then it's also about two cops, played by Alison Tolman and Colin Hanks. She's a much better cop than he is. He's more of a post office worker, which gets realized later. And they're kind of like together trying to solve the crime of what has happened. What were all of the things that are happening involving Billy Bob Thornton and Martin Freeman.
I mean, like, how it's all connected.
Right. This one is very much a Fargo descendant in that, like, Martin Freeman is basically William H. Macy from Fargo, the movie, and,
like,
Alison Tolman is basically
Frances
McDormand, for the movie.
Specific plot points are recreated in... different contexts. It's really weird, but interesting.
It is. They're recreated in the movie where Steve Buscemi hides the briefcase full of money. One of the episodes in season one, somebody finds that briefcase, and it kind of kicks off
like most of the plot of the first season in a backwards kind of way.
Which is like the most direct reference to the film that any of the seasons have. Like, it's the only like real plot thing that's connected.
Mostly it's small references, like one line of dialogue gets lifted and placed in another place. Like, in season one, it's Alison Tolman is asking the deaf hitman, I have it written down here, what was it all for? Or
She's like got him in the back of the squad car.
And for what is the line?
In exactly the way Frances McDormand asked Peter Stormare that.
Right. So my theory enters here with, I think that the other Coen Brothers film that really influenced season one is Burn After Reading.
Okay.
Both of them have in common a general tone of black comedy involving a convoluted crime story sort of woven in. Both of them feature inept members of intelligence agencies, basement murders, and people being pulled into larger conspiracies that no one truly understands.
That's kind of every Coen Brothers movie.
This is true. I think that the influence of Burn After Reading here is primarily felt tonally, as I said, Fargo is at its most concentrated, Fargo the film is at its most concentrated in season one.
Season one is funnier than the movie is, which I think is some of the influence of that. I can see that.
Right. So then season two. Season two is kind of about this small-town cop who believes that a multiple murder at a diner has something more to do with, like, a larger crime syndicate than just being, like, a botched robbery.
Mm-hmm.
It's also about a butcher and his wife who get wrapped up in a hit-and-run, which is also tied to the same crime syndicate, and then that crime syndicate involved in a turf war with the local mafia from Kansas City.
Yeah, they're kind of the linchpin between these three stories that are all happening.
Right. So, season two, as far as I'm concerned, is Fargo crossed with Miller's Crossing.
Okay.
The general tone is certainly more dramatic than season one, but it's still kind of darkly funny.
It's got that kind of orange sepia tone quality to it.
It does. It's definitely a different color palette than the first and the third seasons, which are very blue and gray.
Very, cold and metallic.
Right. This one is...
Especially season three.
Yeah. Season two is a little more sepia.
Yeah.
So they both primarily deal with people covering up crimes and with gang turf wars. Both also feature considerable double crosses, the pitting of a ruthless crime syndicate against a personal code crime syndicate, and a greater focus on race than season one and season three and other Coen Brothers films.
That is true, isn't it?
I thought so. You also see very woodsy settings and everyone out for themselves motif, which I think really recalls Miller's Crossing.
I've only seen that one once. That's one of the ones that I'm not as familiar with.
I watched it, like, in the last week so that I could write about it, because I had this theory based on seasons one and three, and I hadn't seen Miller's Crossing, and I was like, let me just look at the general synopsis for each Coen Brothers movie and see which one would it actually make sense for season two, and sure enough, Miller's Crossing.
Yeah, I can see that.
So that brings me to season three. Season three is... a little bit more difficult to concisely describe.
Season three is a tough one.
But I'm going to try. There are two brothers who have this long-standing disagreement and rivalry.
They're both Ewan McGregor, so if they're not twins, they might as well be.
Yeah, they're not quite twins. They just have that family resemblance. But, I mean, honestly, I didn't recognize Ewan McGregor as Ray, initially.
Yeah. The, like, balding mullet thing.
They put a lot of prosthetics on his face. Yeah. He does not quite look like Ewan McGregor. So it's about their relationship. It's also about one of the brothers' relationship with a parolee. He's a parole officer. One of his parolees is someone he's in a relationship with. And they're also bridge partners. and yeah, they kind of are involved in
competitive,
like...
competitive bridge players.
Right, and they're trying to pull off a crime that involves the other brother, who is in turn trying to expand his business and gets wrapped up in VM Varga, played horrifyingly by David Thewlis.
Yeah. Who's great at being horrifying.
He really is.
Is he also naked?
He's this mysterious figure who rolls in and is doing a lot of morally and legally questionable, legalistic,
yeah,
financial things to make a lot of money quickly.
Sort of a different interpretation of the devil from season one.
Right. And then at the same time, there's a small-town cop. Small-town cops are, like, always in this show.
Yeah.
Stepfather-ish. Ish. Who kind of wrote some books a long time ago. His role in it is not very important, but
yeah,
that's how she gets started and finds all of these connections to other crimes.
Also, there's aliens.
Yeah, there are aliens in season 2 and 3. So, as far as I'm concerned, season 3 is Fargo crossed with A Serious Man.
Okay.
The general tone in both is dark, foreboding, very dark humor.
Michael Stuhlbarg is in both.
He is. I was going to say, both feature forces beyond our control or understanding, tearing people's lives apart. They both involve...
like Michael Stuhlbarg.
Right. They involve deadbeat brothers, marital strife, marijuana use, and Michael Stuhlbarg getting shit on really, really hard.
Yeah.
That just... apparently, Coen brothers love to shit on Michael Stuhlbarg.
He takes it well.
The modern setting and the focus on questions about morality and existence also unite season 3 in A Serious Man.
Wasn't A Serious Man set in the 60s?
Oh, is it?
Is it? I don't know. It's been a while.
I suppose it's been a while since I've seen it. It's kind of weirdly, like... to me, a timeless,
yeah,
thing.
For sure.
It's just an American story about a Jewish man who...
kind of in the way Suburbicon was.
Right.
I don't know if that was... did you see that one?
I haven't.
It's like George Clooney directing a rejected script by the Coen brothers. Like, I think some of which did work into a number of their other films, including A Serious Man. But it's set in... a time that is, like, kind of evocative of the 50s or early 60s, but is not a time, you know? Like, it's...
right.
It's not realism, so it's its own little microcosm.
Like, a date doesn't appear at the beginning of the film, but
yeah,
you generally feel like you kind of know when it is, but it's not definitively a time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, for me, the real, like, the huge tie between A Serious Man and Season 3 is... this like real dark sense of like something's gonna go wrong, and it's definitively gonna go wrong, but people seem to push it out of their minds that it's gonna happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the like the fate sense in,
yeah,
A Serious Man that is constantly making people's lives get worse for no apparent reason,
but...
is embodied in David Thewlis's character.
Okay.
He is actively coming in and doing what fate does in A Serious Man.
Which is fucking everything real hard.
Yeah. It's hard for me to say which season I most appreciate in Fargo. It's probably season 1, but season 3 is a close second. But they're all remarkably good.
I feel sort of the opposite. It's like, oh, season 3 is so...
season 3 is so good.
And season 2 is so fucking good. Oh my god.
The fact that we're having this hard a time picking a favorite should be a sign. And the fact that we use it for Hot Streak also. Mm. So I want to say, it's not only the fact that, like, I can sit here and theorize this
yeah,
deeply about, like, influences on each season and stuff
and
like that.
It's not just like it's one other Coen brother movie either. Like, they're pulling things from all sorts of places. Like, there's that scene in season 3 after the bus thing where, like, she winds up in the bowling alley.
Yeah.
And, like, that's straight out of the fucking Big Lebowski.
Oh, yeah. It is so direct.
Sometimes the bar eats you. Like, just... and you don't expect to see that, and then there it is, and it's like, wait, what? Whoa, what?
Yeah, I mean, that bowling alley scene in season 3 is... a real trip.
Something else.
Put it that way.
Yeah. That's the moment. Like, there's a lot of moments in all three seasons, but it's especially season three where it's like, we are dealing with outside forces here.
Right.
Like, Lauren Malvo could very well be the devil. He might not, though. Like, he could just be a person. But, like, I feel like season three pushes that kind of over the edge a little.
It does. So, I mean, like, so I'm sharing now that theory on other Coen Brothers film influences on individual seasons. I've also, Alex and I have talked a fair bit about Fargo off the podcast. I have taken notes on, like, odd pairs of people who appear in the TV show, which also appear in other TV shows. Mm-hmm. Like, season two, for some reason, includes the two stars from Burn Notice.
Who are they in season two?
So Ronald Reagan is portrayed by Bruce Campbell in season two. And
Forgot about that.
Like, the gruffest of the brothers from the crime syndicate family in season two is played by
the other guy,
Jonathan, what's his name, who's like the star of Burn Notice.
Yeah.
There's also in season three both Michael Stuhlbarg and I know his name, he's the guy who plays Eli in Boardwalk Empire. They're both in Boardwalk Empire.
Fuck, what is his name?
Right.
It's right fucking there.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry,
that guy.
So there's that. There's, like I mentioned, dialogue that gets lifted that we've talked about. We've talked about how Lorne Malvo got named. Like, and in the same season as Lorne Malvo, there's a guy named Gus Grimley, which is just so perfect. It's seriously so complex a show that you could talk that much about it at length.
Yeah.
It's just...
Like, I love this new anthology thing that's happening, like, with that, an American Crime Story, and just, like, telling that kind of story that is contained in that way.
Right.
Fuck.
It's a fascinating adaptation in that it uses Fargo as a jumping-off point, but it's never limited by it as a source material.
Mm-hmm.
It perfectly walks the line between homage and inspiration without dipping into being derivative or simply riding on coattails. I think it's precisely what a television adaptation of a film should be, insofar as that's even a thing that exists.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, like, I feel like there's at least one other good example of that, but I'm not... And, like, good being the operative word, but I'm not quite getting there.
Right. But, yeah, those are our reinterpretations.
Woo.
Which leads us to a topic for next week and weekly recommendations.
Okay. I feel like there was another topic that we were gonna do last time.
It was some of the parts. Like, something that is greater than everything involved.
Its components, okay.
That
could be tough, but...
It is. It's also... I think it's been a while since we've done, like, a personal influence one.
Mm.
Like something that personally inspired you to do something, or be, you know, be creative in a certain way, or, like, even just to take off on this, like, silly Facebook thing I got tagged in. Like, something that as soon as you experienced it, you were like, yeah, this is going to be, like, one of my foundational things.
Okay. I can do that. The like, foundational...
Foundational one. Stuff?
That'd be an interesting, like... I don't know what... But yeah, I'd be curious to try that. I always feel, like, narcissistic when I start going in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly don't have to do it. I just, I think it's fun to throw one of those in every now and then.
Yeah.
It
kind of gives our perspective a little bit of grounding, I guess.
Yeah, I think it also gives us a little bit of characterization for the audience who kind of just gets us talking about,
who gets, like, this essentially excerpt of a conversation.
Right. okay, cool, so that's that. And then, new stuff, weekly.
I haven't done a whole lot this week. Let me see. I did watch Evil Genius. which I think you recommended last week, and like that was some crazy ass shit.
Evil Genius on Netflix. It's an original documentary.
It's four parts about some weird shit that happened in Pennsylvania in like 2003.
Man, good old Bill.
Yeah. Like, what was that guy's deal? Okay. And then, is there anything else that has been good lately?
It's funny, there is a comedy version of, like, inspired based on the actual crime that's in Evil Genius.
Oh yeah, you were telling me about that.
Which I do not recommend. It is not very good. Like, the people involved are good. It's got Jesse Eisenberg and Aziz Ansari and Danny McBride and Nick Swardson, and it is not very good.
That's unfortunate.
I'm referring to 30 Minutes or Less, but you don't need that title because you're not going to watch it.
Do not recommend. I think that's kind of... Let's see. Yeah, it's been sort of a slow week. I haven't really... I did finish Death Note, finally. And I feel like I watched a really good movie, but I cannot remember what it is now. So, I think I'm going to have to pass.
Okay, so this week I have two things that I want to challenge people to go and check out. One of them, the show Atlanta.
I do mean to finish
that. In the last week, I watched both seasons that are out, and seldom have I seen a show more surreal but true to real life. And so densely layered with metaphor and meaning.
It's doing a lot of shit.
Donald Glover and his brother are truly doing something special with Atlanta, so check that out. And the other thing, I recently got to see one of my favorite bands live for the first time. Check out Dr. Dog. Wikipedia describes them as sounding like the Beach Boys and early Beatles. And that is kind of true, but they also have a big lo-fi sort of sound to them.
Like that, but also modern.
Modern and kind of bluesy a lot of times.
Yeah.
They've got wide-ranging stuff. Their newest album is called Critical Equation. It is really good. I would recommend, however, starting with their earliest stuff, like Easy Beat, or my personal favorite albums were three released right in a row. They're called Shame, 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 B-Room, and Be the Void. Those ones are like just start to finish
top notch,
so good. Like I would have used them for Hot Streak if I weren't talking about Paul Simon.
I do have another one. I've been trying to collect albums that are important to me on vinyl, and I've been spending way too much money doing that. And I just got a copy of Quebec by Ween, which is my favorite Ween album. It's like probably the most psychedelic and spaced out. So I would recommend that. It opens with like a Motorhead tribute, kind of.
Oh.
And then there's a song about Zoloft, and a song, like my favorite one is like, on the record, the two sleeves, the inner sleeves have like the lyrics to the songs on each side. And there's a song called The Fuck Jam, and under that it just says nope. but it's one of their strongest works. It's pretty digestible. It's not like the early shit that's like noisy and all over the place, but it's also like kind of out there in an interesting way. And if you just want a song to sample off of it, Transdermal Celebration was the single, and that's a really good one. So yeah.
All right. Well, so this was, I had fun. It was a good episode.
Low energy, chill, rainy Sunday kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that some of the rain sound carried through the window to the microphone, because it was nice.
Yeah, it's actually raining and not just wet.
Yeah, it's a change for Portland lately.
Yeah, usually it's just, it's gross out.
It may be the first time that we have mentioned that we're based in Portland.
I think we've kind of alluded to it a little bit. But, yeah, that's where we are.
Yeah, land of it raining a bunch.
Most of the time.
Yeah. Good times.
Yep.
Well, thanks for listening, folks.
And we'll see you next time.